Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
It's the Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. Good morning again, everyone. With us now, Politico's White House Bureau Chief, Jonathan Lemire, who is also the host of the aptly named MSNBC show, Way Too Early, weekdays at 5 a.m. Eastern. And he's a regular presence on Morning Joe on MSNBC, as some of you know. And now Jonathan Lemire has a book called The Big Lie, Election Chaos, Political Opportunism, and the State of American Politics After 2020. The book has already made news for some of its content, including a quote attributed to Steve Bannon saying Trump would lie about anything, a take that Trump got away with the 2020 big lie to the extent that he has because he was never held accountable for his election fraud lies from the 2016 campaign. And I'm especially interested in Jonathan's last chapter that describes party leaders as having gone from condemning the Capitol attack to downplaying it to coming to terms with it, and how we're seeing GOP candidates around the country running on changing the laws for how votes are counted and elections are certified, really threatening as far as I'm concerned. Jonathan, always an honor that after you are up way too early, that you stay up late with us. Maybe our 11 a.m. is your 11 p.m. So thanks and welcome back to WNYC.
That is my pleasure. Thank you for having me. It's always great.
And you write that the big lie started not in 2020, but in 2016. Take us there.
That is correct. I was there for an otherwise uneventful rally on a sleepy Monday, August 1st, 2016, at a convention center in Columbus, Ohio. I was with the Associated Press at the time, covering then candidate Trump. And about halfway through his remarks, which were not exactly electrifying, he suggested for the first time that the general election being conducted that fall would not be conducted fairly, that it would be rigged. And we immediately had never been there before as a nation. Some of your listeners will surely remember earlier that year, he had made claims about the Iowa caucus and the Republican National Committee would have perhaps conspired against it. But that was sour grapes for a loss. That was intra-party squabbling. This was very different. This was the fundamental tenet of American democracy, the vote. And he was saying it wouldn't be counted fairly. I immediately had a new lead for my story that morning. And we saw it build during that campaign. We recall in the first general election debate against Hillary Clinton, he repeated that false assertion and said that he would not necessarily honor the result. I also uncover for the book an interview with Roger Stone around that same time in which he predicted that what Trump should do, would be that on election night, if he were to lose, to claim that he won anyway. He used Florida as an example to say, well, look, the polls have Trump up in Florida now, so therefore, if he ends up losing it, then the election was stolen, and he even predicted there could be violence. Now, as it turned out, they were 4 years early. Trump, of course, won that election. He did commission a voter fraud to look at a commission to look into the idea that because of illegal balloting, just so happened because he lost the popular vote, was trying to justify that. But largely, that came and went with just a few headlines. But what the book shows and traces over his 4 years of presidency is that he slowly, slowly, slowly built towards the big lie of 2020.
You know, you remind us of, I guess, what is a footnote to history, that after Trump was elected in 2016 but lost the popular vote to Hillary Clinton by about 3 million votes, he did impanel this election fraud investigative team to try to prove that he actually won the popular vote, too. And they never really found anything. They kind of got disbanded without even a real report, if I remember correctly. Could you remind us a little more about what that group actually found or didn't?
They found very little. Chris Kobach, who was the Kansas official, was put in charge of it. It was nominally placed under the vice president's office, but he didn't do it. Pence didn't have anything to do with it. Kobach, who was known for his hardline immigration stances and later failed run for Senate, led the committee. And they particularly were looking at places like New Hampshire, where they thought that clearly Democratic voters were being bussed over the line from Massachusetts, or California, where illegal immigrants were voting. And yes, to your point, Trump suggested there were just as many illegal votes out there as his deficit in the popular vote to Hillary Clinton. It did indeed came and went. There was even some pushback from Republican state officials. A report was written and only released because of a lawsuit that forced to be produced a short time later. But they came and went, and most Americans shrugged it off. But Trump never did let it go. He still, years later, believed that he had the popular vote victory stolen from him. Now, of course, this was in many ways him just refusing to accept that he lost that to Hillary Clinton.
You say he believed. We don't know if he believed it, right? I mean, we don't know to this day if he believes the big lie about 2020.
People close to the president, who I spoke to for this book and obviously my day-to-day reporting, say that at this point he does, that he had convinced himself of that truth. Now, I detail in the book, in the days after the 2020 election, he was telling people that he couldn't believe he lost to Joe Biden. There was certainly an acceptance there, an anger, but sort of a realization that he had been defeated. But as he surrounded himself by the Sidney Powells and Rudy Giuliani's and Michael Flynn's of the world, who fed in these conspiracy theories, he eventually convinced himself of that truth. Now, can we ever know truly what is in the mind or hearts of another person? No. But certainly those close to Donald Trump say at this point he does believe it, and publicly and privately, since the days after the election, has only said one thing, is that he believed the election was stolen.
How can he believe it without any evidence having come forward that there were enough fraudulent votes in all these swing states to flip the election?
He will say there's evidence. And of course, you and I know better, and that's part of the lie. But he will point to the conspiracy theories about voting machines or international cabals or some far-flung global network to try to defeat him. That he will say the mail in particular, those mail-in ballots that became so popular during the pandemic, were central to this fraud perpetrated against him. So he is not going to be dissuaded by what we perceive as evidence. And that is going to be a challenge to us all as Donald Trump now seemingly prepares to run for president again, and still saying over and over, he's done so this week, that he won the 2020 election. And it's going to require an extraordinary amount of fact-checking and diligence by those of us covering him, the media, to make sure that we present the facts to the public, even though he is intent on doing exactly the opposite.
So listeners, your calls welcome for Jonathan Lemire, Politico's White House Bureau Chief, host of Way Too Early weekdays at 5 a.m. Eastern on MSNBC, prominent presence on Morning Joe on MSNBC, and now the author of The Big Lie, Election Chaos, Political Opportunism, and the State of American Politics After 2020, 212-433-WNYC, 212-433-9692, or tweet at Brian Lehrer. So to circle back to the premise, one of the premises from the early part of your book, that Trump got away with the 2020 big lie to the extent that he has because he was never held accountable for his election fraud lies from the 2016 campaign. How could he have been held accountable for that, but wasn't?
There could have been a moment any time during his presidency where the Republican Party drew a line, and they did not. There are, we've certainly had presidents of our past who, you know, at times squabble with members of their own party. We're seeing it right now, where President Joe Biden, of course, cannot get Senator Manchin, Senator Sinema, along with every piece of his agenda. There was no need. The Republicans could have been supportive of Trump's legislative agenda without indulging the lies. And what the book traces in detail is how Donald Trump hijacked both the Republican Party, but also the conservative media to go along with and amplify his lies, big and small. Some of them nonsensical about, say, the size of the crowd at his inauguration, or the fact that he made a mistake while tweeting about the path of a hurricane, saying it was going to hit Alabama when it actually wasn't. But in both of those cases, what's actually dangerous and what foreshadowed what were to come is that the power that he used the powers of government, the levers of government, to justify his lies. A National Park Service employee doctored photographs to make his crowd look bigger on the mall during his inauguration. And as for the hurricane, the NOAA, the team of meteorologists, basically put out a report that suggested that their forecast had been mistakenly published and that actually Trump was right and that this storm had threatened Alabama. Both these relatively small incidents, but show how he was unafraid to use every means as a tool at his disposal for his own political power, whether it is to avoid embarrassment or to win an election.
You could do like a whole Trump propaganda trivia quiz based on these things in the book that a lot of our listeners probably heard at the time, have completely forgotten about, like that tweet about the path of the hurricane. And you mentioned Inauguration Day. I always thought that that was really the signal of what his presidency was going to be about from a truth and lies standpoint. Right on Inauguration Day, when he sent out his press secretary to insist that, contrary to reporting with people's own eyes, his inauguration crowd was bigger than President Obama's. So did you sense that this was going to be that kind of up is down is up propaganda machine from Inauguration Day 2017?
I was in the briefing room that day when Sean Spicer, in his ill-fitting suit, came out to insist that Trump's crowd was bigger than Obama's on a day where he was not supposed to brief the press. Trump made him go out there because he was so angry at the media coverage of not just the size of the crowd to his inauguration, but the size of the women's march that was happening in D.C. and elsewhere on January 21st, the day after the inauguration. And yes, I mean, I had covered the Trump campaign in 2016 and certainly knew that he was not bound to the usual tenets of truth like the rest of us. But even so, it took on a different meaning and weight when it was done from the White House, when it was done from the White House podium, when it was done from behind the Resolute desk in the Oval Office, that suddenly he was no longer just a candidate in 2016, even spouting election fraud. As dangerous as that is for a party's nominee to be doing so, it's far more so when the president of the United States, who has the power of the federal government behind him, would be embracing such lies, whether trivial ones like crowd size or huge ones about voter fraud.
Philip in Yonkers, you're on WNYC with Jonathan Lemire. Hi, Philip.
Hi, good morning. You guys were just talking about whether Trump actually believes the big lie and that maybe he's convinced himself, which I think is what you said. I think you said maybe you've heard from people that he's convinced himself. I think that's extremely ridiculous and irresponsible for any kind of journalist to say. It's insane. We all know he's a liar. I think the New York Times, you know, registered that he's lied 13,000 times or something. And to even indulge in the idea that he may be telling the truth or that he maybe believes it, why can't you just be a man and say, obviously, he's lying. He doesn't believe it. It's insane to say that he, and it's not even funny. It's insane.
No, what's funny is that you're impugning Jonathan's manhood because he's quoting his sources in the context of a book that is all about Donald Trump as a liar. But Jonathan, you get why it's hard for people to believe. And I think one of the points of the January 6th committee hearings so far has been to establish that so many people who Trump trusted in his inner circle, William Barr is the most obvious example, but there are so many, told him that the election was not stolen. And yet he maybe believes it, like your sources tell you. But I think a lot of the point of this particular stream of testimony at the hearings has been to establish that, yeah, Trump knows this is a lie and he was trying to get himself to remain in power anyway.
Right. The entire book, as you just say, details Donald Trump's history of lying from private citizen to candidate to president and now potentially candidate again. And a lot of prominent people in his orbit. You mentioned the attorney general. We now know that his own daughter and senior advisor, Ivanka Trump, agreed with William Barr's assessment that there was no voter fraud. Trump heard this every single day. And whether he believed it or not is almost immaterial. As you point out, I'm simply reporting what people have told me and countless other reporters throughout the beat. But whether he in his heart knew he had lost or not, he acted as if he had. And he acted as if he did believe the lies. And that is far more dangerous. No one's giving him the best benefit of the doubt whatsoever. We in our day, my day-to-day coverage, as well as the book, plainly calls out what he's doing as the most dangerous threat to American democracy since the Civil War. And the January 6th committee has done a very effective job laying that out, and doing so, I might add, through the voices of Republicans, through the voices of Trump administration officials, through the voices sometimes of his closest aides. These aren't Democrats. These aren't never Trumpers making the case. That's not who's testifying. This is the inner circle, for the most part, true believers who were there with him until the end, except January 6th was the one line they wouldn't cross.
We'll continue in a minute with Jonathan Lemire. Stay with us. Brian Lehrer on WNYC with Politico's White House bureau chief, Jonathan Lemire, who's the author of a new book called The Big Lie, Election Chaos, Political Opportunism, and the State of American Politics After 2020. Jonathan also hosts the MSNBC show Way Too Early, weekdays at 5 a.m. And actually, Jonathan, I was thinking that since that's a national show, on the West Coast, it's 2 a.m. You could call the show Way Too Late.
I also will note that a couple of weeks ago, I traveled with President Biden to Europe for a pair of summits when it aired at 11 a.m. local. So for at least that week, it was appropriately timed with John Polamere.
Well, you know, I actually know a journalist who had to put out a piece of work every day by 6 a.m. Eastern time. And I guess he had some flexibility in his life. And he actually moved to Europe so that he could be living kind of regular hours and not get up in the middle of the night to do it. So that's one way to tweak that schedule. But 2 a.m.
So what you're saying is MSNBC needs a Madrid bureau.
I think they need one very badly, very badly. Tammy in Boston, you're on WNYC with Jonathan Lemire. Hi, Tammy.
Hi, good morning. I would like to express my dismay that it sounds a little bit like Jonathan is took a sip of the Kool-Aid when he says that this is what his sources are puppets. You know, they're mouthpieces for him. Trump, unlike Jim Jones, he would never drink his own Kool-Aid. But, you know, I refer to him now as America's Taliban. And he is a vicious,
America's what? Taliban?
Yes. And I'm going to make a bumper sticker and get some hats out there and T-shirts. But that's exactly what he is. He's America's Taliban. He is worse than Jim Jones. At least Jim Jones had did us a favor and drank his own Kool-Aid. But Trump, you know, in Billy Bush's tape on that bus, and I think in many, many other speeches, Donald Trump said repeatedly, I think he was bragging to Billy Bush on that bus, that if you tell the same lie over and over and over again, thousands of times, they'll believe it. They'll believe anything. That's how he operates.
Tammy, thank you very much. So address Tammy, and also maybe in this context, bring up that Steve Bannon quote from the book that's broken out a little bit, saying that Trump would lie about anything.
Yeah, Steve Bannon would tell people at the White House, and this is, let's remember who people probably don't need a refresher who Bannon is, but he's a former head of Breitbart News, a real right-wing provocateur, just was convicted last week for contempt of Congress because he wouldn't comply with subpoena during the January 6th investigation. He took over the stretch run of the Trump campaign in 2016 and then had a relatively brief tenure in the White House. And he would tell aides that he couldn't believe just at the sheer ferocity and frequency of Trump's lies, that he would lie about literally anything, that he would lie not to win a news cycle, as the saying goes, but a news hour or a news minute or a news moment, just to try to change a cable chyron or just get a brief upper hand in an exchange with a reporter. Trump was a pathological liar. That's according to the people close to him. The people close to him know that Trump lies about everything or many things. And certainly he voices the opinion that he believes the election was stolen. As we covered a little earlier, what's in his heart is impossible for any man to see. We know it's a lie, but he's acting on it anyway. And that is what's so dangerous, whether he believes it or not.
What do you make of Bannon's contempt of Congress conviction the other day? He didn't seem to put up much of a legal fight.
No, in fact, he was called out very much so for not doing so. Bannon is someone who has always sort of embraced the idea of being a MAGA martyr, in his words, that he is trying to, first of all, he was pardoned by then President Trump for a scam that included defrauding Trump supporters of money trying to build a border wall with Mexico. He's fallen in and out of Trump's good graces. He's now back in. And this is a demonstration of loyalty. And he believes a demonstration of trying to show that the system, the legal system, is rigged against Trump and his allies by not cooperating with the January 6th committee and then taking the guilty verdict without putting up much of a fight. It remains unknown whether he'll serve much of the way of prison time, but certainly this is his way of still being at the very forefront of the Trump movement, establishing his bona fides, if you will. And there is certainly an expectation that if Trump were to run again, Bannon would be, even if not an official member of the campaign, but a leading voice.
Yeah, and I was thinking that since the law, as I understand it, requires at least a 30-day sentence for contempt of Congress for refusing to testify under subpoena before the January 6th committee, that maybe Steve Bannon has reached the point where, as you say, as a MAGA martyr, he's actually willing to go to jail for a month or more in order to kind of pull this political stunt, which starts a whole other thread in that world of we are now political prisoners.
I think that is a very reasonable assessment, and people in that world have floated similar scenarios where the Bannon wouldn't mind even being locked up for a while because of the symbolism it would provide.
Jennifer in East Harlem, you're on WNYC with Jonathan Lemire. Hi, Jennifer.
Yes, good morning, Brian. Thank you for taking my call. And, you know, I understand much more of the psychological underpinnings, and we all have been aghast for years over the pathological lying and misinformation that Trump has propagated. What I don't understand is why he has not formally faced fraud charges. I mean, for example, with someone like Bernie Madoff, who destroyed lives financially through his scheming and lying, he faced over 100 years in prison. Trump is destroying our country and is hurting, you know, countless lives in the process. Why is he not formally facing fraud charges for this level of lying and misinformation?
Thank you, Jennifer. That's such an interesting question. And of course, Jonathan, I know a standard answer is you can't prosecute politicians for lying to the public, otherwise they'd all be in jail. But she's laying out the scenario under which it's beyond just a lie, it's a fraud because of the extent of it and the consequences of it. And maybe there's some kind of fraud statute that would apply. Have you heard that theory before? Have you heard any lawyers discuss that possibility?
Preliminarily, so yes. I think there are a lot of legal fronts, though, open against the former president. And they go far beyond what we're seeing in the January 6th committee. And even there, there seems to be some momentum in the Department of Justice. We heard from Attorney General Merrick Garland last week. He, as we know, has been receiving a lot of criticism from Democrats, frustrated at the slow pace, they think, of his investigation. He's also giving an interview tonight on NBC, I should note. And that there seems to be potentially a roadmap being laid out by the committee for possible criminal charges against Trump, including for incitement. And then we also know that even though the criminal case in New York seems to have stalled, the one in Fulton County, Georgia, very much has not. And that's a very active case there where both Trump and some of his closest allies may be in some legal jeopardy. So that is also part of the thinking, people close to Trump tell me, as to why the former president is considering declaring his candidacy for 2024 sooner than later. Traditionally, it would be after the midterms. Nearly all Republicans, even those who support Donald Trump running for office again, want him to wait till after the midterms. They don't want him to be a distraction in a moment where the GOP feels like they'll do well in November. But Trump is eyeing a much earlier return to the stage. He's giving a prominent speech today, in fact, in Washington, because for two reasons. One, he is anxious, people tell me, about the publicity the January 6th committee has received. He wants to change that narrative. He also wants to send a warning signal to other Republicans who might be considered challenging him, namely Governor Ron DeSantis. If he jumps in first, he believes others won't. And then lastly, if he is a declared candidate, there's at least a thought that might make prosecutors a little more reluctant to go after him. He wouldn't just be a former president. He would be the favorite for the GOP nomination in 2024.
You know, I keep hearing that theory, but is there anything legal behind it, or is it just sort of political and public relations oriented? Is there any legal reason that it's harder to prosecute a declared presidential candidate than it is if he's not one yet?
No, not a legal reason. There's a Department of Justice guidelines about avoiding investigations so close to an election, which of course, or at least commenting about them, which of course will anger so many Democrats, because James Comey, the FBI director, did just that 2 weeks before the 2016 election when he announced that he was taking another look at Hillary Clinton's emails. There is a guideline in the Department of Justice to not charge a sitting president. So that is what we all encountered during the Mueller investigation. So that's a real thing. In terms of a candidate, though, no, it's more of a tradition. So that doesn't necessarily mean that it's one that any prosecutor would have to follow.
Also on the legal track, there is news today, you've probably seen this, that two of Mike Pence's top advisors have testified not just before the January 6th committee, but before a grand jury investigating January 6th, which means it's a criminal investigation of some kind. And I want to play a clip. This will remind some people who may have seen Greg Jacobs' very dramatic testimony before the January 6th committee, but then forgot about him because he's not much of a public figure. Otherwise, he was the chief counsel to Vice President Pence on and around January 6th. And in this clip from his live testimony before the committee, he's describing warning Trump lawyer John Eastman, who's trying to get Pence to somehow say that he can reject the electoral votes, to do so. And Eastman seems to suggest here that they break the law. With knowledge of breaking the law, this is a little bit of how Greg Jacob described that.
And then he implored me, now that we have established that the Electoral Count Act isn't so sacrosanct as you have made it out to be, I implore you one last time, can the Vice President please do what we've been asking him to do these last 2 days, suspend the joint session, send it back to the states.
So, Jonathan, one way to hear that clip is that John Eastman was saying, I know this is the law, but because other people have played fast and loose with the law in some other respects, in his estimation, let's just ignore this law and do something illegal anyway and deny the electoral votes. Do you think that that might be the basis of the grand jury's investigation that had Greg Jacob testifying, or do you have any other information about that?
Well, grand juries, of course, work in secret, but that certainly is a possibility. We know there has been an active probe in the District of Columbia. It just so happened that Mark Short was captured leaving the courtroom on Friday because there was a phalanx of TV cameras set out up front for Steve Bannon. So that's sort of how news of this came
that's
out.
That's funny. Mark Short, Pence's chief of staff at that time, yeah.
Correct. They saw him leave and went, wait, what's this about? And then figured it out from there. But it should be understood, it's not just Jacob, but Mark Short, of course, he was, as you said, the chief of staff. He was also with Vice President Pence on January 6th. He was one of the few aides that was with him for most of the day at the Capitol. So certainly could provide testimony there, as well as being an important advisor who was privy to some of the White House meetings about this idea of not honoring the Electoral College vote. There was this pressure campaign to have Pence to go along with that. Pence, of course, on January 6th, refused to do so.
So to finish up, I mentioned in the intro the final chapter of your book, which looks forward, and my concern that we may be heading to this time when votes are counted honestly in some states and not counted honestly in other states, because people are running for governor in some places, people are running for other state offices in some places, on changing the election laws, not for how people are allowed to vote, but how the votes are counted and how elections are certified. I'm curious how much you see that as a threat as we head toward 2024?
It's a significant threat. What the book does, it's not just a Trump book and certainly doesn't end with January 6th. In fact, the back half of the book is everything that's happened since then. Republicans using the big lie as cover to tighten access to the ballot in nearly two dozen states across the country, but also doing what you're saying, putting up Trump-friendly candidates, big lie-friendly candidates who for governor, for secretaries of state, state secretaries of state, who will have a significant role in investigations into the vote, into the certification of the vote, where a lot of Democrats and good government groups deeply nervous about what this means for 2022 and especially 2024, if a lot of those candidates win this year. And this is partially why the Electoral Count Act is there's hopefully progress being made there on Capitol Hill to change that process around January 6th. There's also why there's frustration among Democrats that the Biden administration and the Democrats in Congress were not able to get federal voting law protections passed earlier this year. That's also captured in the book. And it makes clear the Republicans have embraced the big lie. Legitimate political discourse are three words the National Party used to describe what happened on January 6th. Not insurrection, not a riot, not violence, legitimate political discourse. And it shows the shadow of Trump's lie did not just fuel the violence of January 6th, but it's going to define this year and in 2024.
All right, your phone is breaking up just at the right moment because we are out of time to talk about the content of the book, The Big Lie, Election Chaos, Political Opportunism, and the State of American Politics After 2020, with Jonathan Lemire, the author and Politico's White House Bureau Chief and host of the MSNBC show Way Too Early. Wake up way too early at 5 a.m. Eastern if you want to see it on MSNBC, or stay up way too late if you're one of our California listeners and see it at 2 a.m. Pacific time. Jonathan, we always appreciate it. Thanks a lot. Congratulations on the book.
Thank you so much.